Following the speeches by community organizations, a panel of three experts on civic planning and governance shared their thoughts about city planning and procedures. Two of those panelists were Brian Kelsey, former policy advisor to Mayor Cates and author of the blog stateofthecity.ca, and Richard Milgram.
Two things I'll focus on, and that is that both, you know, from my own work experience and my own bizarre politics, in the sense that I'm kind of a conservative urbanist or a green conservative who believes in density, and I believe in urban density as a weapon against climate change, which I believe is actually, you know, being influenced by man-made forces and so forth. You know, sometimes I may disagree from an outcome standpoint with even some of the presenters we've heard tonight. I do believe we as a city and we as a society need to find ways to allow for more density in our cities and more creative use of the land that we've got and more efficient use of the land that we've got. And sometimes that's going to lead to results where existing neighborhoods and people in existing neighborhoods, often for very legitimate reasons, are going to panic and have legitimate questions to raise. And the point I want to start and maybe finish with, to leave as much time open for questions, is that a well-run city, a city with good government, to refer to your earlier point, is a city that trains itself in the skill of managing those conflicts. I mean, my first words to the city politics class I taught at the U of W last fall were that essentially what makes city government unique and distinguishes it from pretty much anything else in government, it's got a very specific mission, whether it's in services or in lawmaking or in development and land use planning, that city government is about managing the conflicts and the opportunities that come from humans living together in a dense environment. That it's that density that makes civic government so controversial and makes so many of these issues so controversial, and that you have one property owner living beside another property owner and one renter living beside a building right beside them that may be a fire hall and so forth. And so you've got a constant clash, and the reason we pay city politicians is to lead and manage our way through, so that at least if you're getting to an outcome that some of us might not like, that might be better for the city's sake, at least you've heard that explanation. At least you can believe sincerely in the motives and believe sincerely in the intended outcomes that are being brought forward to you. Right now we don't have good government. The phrase I use most often in media interviews is toxic government. And I believe we have a toxic government here in the city of Winnipeg, in part because an earlier speaker spoke about how there was a sense that there were two different processes at work. To me, especially after I left in 2008, I've described what we're seeing in City Hall, not just at the in the mayor's office, but I think it's also important to say with some councillors and with many senior public servants, it used to be a few, but this is spreading, is what I call a deal-maker culture. In the sense that even if there would be a positive outcome to some of the proposals that are coming forward, or some of the, to the sale of a particular parcel of land for development, for example, even if there might be an acceptable or really positive or exciting way to get to development of that land, that we are angering you, you use we loosely here, we are angering you and we are confusing the public, and we are even angering developers and business owners who might want to participate and bring forward other ideas by treating public land as if it's a private asset to be disposed of internally by internal processes with the city of Winnipeg. We haven't talked a lot about this tonight, and for very understandable reasons, Dennis, but I know you won't object if I go down the list of issues that I've certainly been raising in terms of sole sourcing of land, creation of processes that would effectively result in the sole sourcing of land, arbitrary and confidential appraisals of land for sale, a joint venture that was recently announced at a price that seemed to me to be awfully low for the large volume of sole-sourced land that was involved. I can give you a long list. Land swaps. I am professionally and personally opposed to land swaps under almost any circumstances, because it's very easy to start trading land without having a public appraisal on what's there, and it's very easy to disturb the residents and make future development more difficult, in fact, paradoxically, because people are left feeling suspicious about what the motives behind the land swap were. I mean, obviously, if somebody's swapping land with a developer, the intent is to develop at the back end of that swap. So whatever comes forward tonight, where I'm likely, most likely to agree with all of you, and where I'm definitely likely to agree with at least some of you, is in terms of the need for predictable processes, the need for respectable processes that have everybody involved. I was a strong proponent of secondary plans during my work in the mayor's office with the Red Tape Commission. Ironically, Russ Wyatt was, I used to say, the strongest proponent on council internally in that process, that he was insistent that we needed more secondary plans. And I guess it depends on what the secondary plan is from one day to the next as to whether he's supporting it or not. But the reason those processes are so important is that it's not just important that we engage as a city those of you who have concerns that can be mitigated. It's equally important that all the other stakeholders in the city, unions, public servants, private business, other developers, people who are willing to pay more money for public land into our coffers than people who might otherwise be at the front of the line, all of those different people, other regulators, all of those other stakeholders need to be a part of the process and believe they're a part of the process if we're going to get positive outcomes in terms of the overall growth of our city, however long and painful it might be to handle it that way. So I hope that spirit carries through in my comments tonight and look forward to any questions you've got.
Thank you, Brian. Now we'll hear from Richard Milgram, who's teaching actually the head of the City Planning Department at the University of Manitoba, and he's also an active member of the Planners Network. Richard?
There are two other cities I wanted to talk about really quickly. I was at a conference in Calgary about urban design in October, and I don't expect a lot from Calgary for political reasons. But they are doing a remarkably good job of researching the impacts of business as usual planning and development, as they call it, and alternative models and patterns of development. And that's something that should be happening here, and I don't think the city will ever do it, and I'm not sure why the province will never do it. I mean, it's very important to have neighborhood-based planning, but neighborhood planning has to happen within the context of what's happening in the region and the city, and we can't make good decisions. Neighborhoods change, cities grow, these things are going to happen. I'm going to come back to that. But, you know, we should be involved in how that happens, but in an informed way. And if we don't have the research, we don't know what the impacts are going to be. So actually, I always say one of the Winnipeg's biggest problems is that we don't have a regional plan. So we're starting to develop big sprawling suburbs because we want to keep the money in the city instead of having it go to East St. Paul. So I've been calling that preemptive sprawl. You know, we want to get the taxes from that before someone goes out to the burbs, or further out to the burbs. But Calgary's doing very good research, and we need to be doing that research. And the city isn't going to do it, and I'm trying to find ways that the university can do it. But, you know, we're right now a department of four people. We used to be more. She's promised me wine on days when I'm stressed, which I haven't taken up on yet, it's true. The other thing is I worked in Minneapolis for a year before coming back to Winnipeg 8 years ago. And they went through a very interesting process which was led by the council. So this, where they said to neighborhoods, the city is going to grow. And I mean, they're landlocked, which is a bit of an advantage for planners because they can say, you know, we have to look at how to intensify. I mean, we should be wallet locked or something because we have an $8 billion sprawl deficit right now. But they went to the neighborhoods and said, we are going to grow. Density is going to have to happen in and around you somehow. How would you like that to happen? Instead of saying, will you accept it? They said, you know, it's going to happen. And it is going to happen. If we want to have a economically sustainable city, that actually has to happen too. So if we are going to accept density, how is it going to be shaped? And then they started working with groups, and this was just a pilot project, and to be honest, I don't know where it's gone, but it seems like it's going the right way. To say to neighborhoods, what will you accept? What would you like developers to do? How would you like to accommodate the density? And out of that came a series of guidelines for neighborhoods and particular sites where the neighborhood could then say to developers, if you come and build this, not only won't we oppose you, but we will support you. Which developers actually like. despite the fact that we have a culture here of developers thinking, well, we can do whatever we want, we'll just go in and change the rules, that still takes them time. They would still be happier if they could come in and just build something and it would be accepted.